parties fighting right now had killed Yukiko and Yumiko. But what if Yukiko and Yumiko's killer heard this gunfire? He could show up at any moment. More gunfire was exchanged, and then silence again. Shuya clenched his teeth. He quickly let Noriko down. He had her rest against the tree trunk where they were hiding. Shogo turned around. "Hey, you're not..." Shuya ignored him and said to Noriko, "I'll go check it out." He pulled out his Smith & Wesson and said to Shogo, "Look after Noriko." "Hey!" He heard Shogo, but he was already on his way. He climbed the slope carefully, keeping an eye on all sides, and made his way through the conifers. There was thick vegetation beyond the trees. Shuya made his way into it. He got down on the ground and proceeded to push through the long, sharp needles pricking at him from all sides. More gunshots. Shuya finally reached the edge of the grove and slowly poked his head out. There was an old, single-story wood building with a triangular roof, a typical farmhouse. On his left was an unpaved entrance road. The mountain escarpment surrounded the property further down, and the area above was covered in deep forest. And even further up, you could see the viewing platform on the northern mountain where Yumiko and Yukiko had been killed. The farmhouse was on his left side. Hirono Shimizu, female student number 10, was crouched against the wall in front of the building. Hirono was looking beyond the yard at what appeared to be a shack for farm equipment right beside the entrance road. He could make out the figure of a girl beside the entrance. The two girls were less than 15 meters apart, and both of them were holding guns. He had no idea how they ended up shooting at each other. It was possible one of them was out to get the other girl, but Shuya could tell this wasn't the case. They probably stumbled into each other, and because neither of them could trust the other, they ended up shooting at one another. This guess might have just been based on his own favorable opinion of girls, but in any case, he couldn't just sit back and let this happen. He had to stop them. As Shuya tried to grasp the situation, Kaori stuck her head out from the shack's entrance and fired at Hirono. She handled the gun like a kid playing with a water pistol, but unlike a water pistol, the gun exploded and a small brass shell flew into the air. Hirono fired two shots back. She actually handled the gun well, and her shells didn't fly out. One of her bullets hit the post of the shack, which shattered into sawdust. Kaori quickly pulled her head in. Hirono's body was almost entirely visible from where Shuya was standing, and he saw her open the cylinder of her revolver to extract the shells. Her left hand was soaked crimson. Her right arm might have been wounded by Kaori, but she managed to reload her gun quickly with that hand. She aimed her gun at Kaori again. All of this happened in a matter of seconds, but right before he was about to act, Shuya was once again overwhelmed by the sensation of being trapped in a nightmare. Kaori Minami loved pop idols, so she'd often talk about her favorite stars with her friends, or share a photo taken in person that thrilled her to no end. Then there was Hirono Shimizu, who hung out with Mitsuko Sauma, so there was something jaded about her. But they were both third-year students in junior high, and they both had charming qualities. Now these two were shooting at each other. Seriously. With real bullets, obviously. "I have to do something now." Shuya stood up and fired his Smith & Wesson into the air. "Oh, great. So now I'm playing the sheriff," he thought for a moment. But without hesitating, he shouted, "Stop!" Hirono and Kaori froze and then together looked over at Shuya. "Stop it. I'm with Noriko Nakagawa." He thought it was best not to mention Shogo's name for now. "You can trust me." As he said this, he realized how lame his words sounded. But he had no other way to put it. Hirono was the first to move her eyes away from Shuya to Kaori, and Kaori was gazing at Shuya. Shuya realized at that moment how half of Kaori's body was exposed beyond the entrance. She was in the open now. What happened next reminded him of a traffic accident he once witnessed. It happened on an autumn evening before he turned 11. Maybe the driver had fallen asleep or something. He lost control of his truck, rammed through the guardrail, rode up onto the sidewalk, and hit a young girl walking home from school, just like Shuya, who was behind her. It was unbelievable, but her backpack came off her shoulders and flew into the air, tracing a different trajectory from the girl's body. The girl landed on the sidewalk before the backpack did, falling on her shoulder. Obstructed by the concrete wall, she slid along the edge of the sidewalk and then stopped still. Blood came flowing out, leaving a trail over a meter long on the bottom edge of the concrete wall. It all looked like, from the time the truck swung off the road and crashed into the girl, as if it was happening in slow motion. Anyone there could tell what was going to happen, but there was nothing anyone could do. That was what it felt like. Hirono aimed and fired at Kaori, who'd completely let her guard down. Two shots in a row. The first one hit Kaori in the shoulder, making her spin halfway to the right. The second shot hit her in the head. Shuya saw a part of her head, from the top down to her left temple, explode. Kaori collapsed by the front door of the shack. Hirono glanced over at Shuya. Then she turned and ran to his left, westward, where Shuya's group had come from. She ran into the bushes and disappeared from sight. "Damn," Shuya moaned. After some hesitation, he ran to the shack where Kaori had collapsed. Kaori was on her back, legs jutting out from inside the shack that only housed a decrepit tractor. Her body remained twisted as blood came flowing out the corner of her mouth, mixed with the blood from her head and shoulder wounds, and turned into a puddle on the shack's concrete floor. Tiny dust particles from the floor were floating on the surface of the puddle. Her eyes stared out at the sky. A thin gold chain hung down from her sailor suit onto the floor, and the golden locket attached to it looked like an island in a lake of blood. A famous male idol singer was smiling cheerfully from it. Shuya was shaking as he knelt down beside her. "Oh man, what the... So this girl can't gossip about pop idols anymore. She can't go to their concerts anymore. If he had been more careful, maybe she wouldn't have been killed." He heard a sound and turned around. It was Shogo, holding Noriko in one of his arms as they took a step out from the woods. Shogo left Noriko there and trotted over to Shuya. Shogo's expression seemed to be saying, "See, what'd I tell you?" But he didn't say a word. He just calmly picked up Kaori's gun and day pack, and then, as if it occurred to him as an afterthought, he crouched down and shut her eyes with his right thumb. Then he told Shuya, "We're going. Hurry up." He knew it was dangerous. Anyone, especially the killer with the machine gun, could have heard the gunfire and might be showing up soon. Still, Shuya's eyes were glued to Kaori's corpse until Shogo tugged on his arm. 22 students remaining. Chapter 41. The medical clinic was an old, small, single-story building. The wood walls had turned black, and the black-tiled roof was so worn out with age that the corners had turned white. Like the shack where Kaori Minami had died, it was located in front of the northern mountain at the end of a narrow, unpaved road. They'd made their way past the mountain, but they could tell the narrow entrance road led down to the paved road along the island's eastern shore. There was a white minivan parked in front of the facility. Maybe the doctor used it for house calls. Beyond the minivan, they could see the ocean. The afternoon sun was shining on the sea. The color of the ocean was completely different from the murky water that lapped against the concrete seawalls in Shiroiwa Harbor. It was a wonderfully brilliant blue tinged with green. There were hardly any waves, and the sparkling dots of light on the surface grew densely packed in the distance. Other islands floating in the Seto Inland Sea looked to be close, but this was probably due, as Shuya was once told, to the optical illusion of reduced distance when objects were absent. So they must have been at least 4 or 5 kilometers away. In any case, they were here. It was a miracle they'd gotten here without getting hurt. They'd immediately left the area where Kaori died. No machine gun shots came after them. According to the map, they traveled a distance of less than 2 kilometers, but Shuya, who who'd been carrying Noriko and was worried about a possible attack, was incredibly tired. He wanted to check to make sure no one was in the area of the clinic as soon as possible so that not only Noriko, but he too could get some rest. But something caught Shuya's attention. A ship was floating on the peaceful sea. It was probably the guardship Sakamochi had mentioned. But for some reason, there were three ships in a row. Sakamochi said there would be one ship on all sides, north, south, east, and west. And on the west side, they had seen only one. So what was this? Still carrying Noriko, Shuya poked his face out from the leaves and said to Shogo, "There's three ships." "Yeah," Shogo replied. "The small one is a guardship. The huge one is the ship that will transport the soldiers who were in the school building back to their base. The one in the middle is for the winner of the game. The winner rides that boat. It's the same model as the one from last year." So the program in Hyogo Prefecture was also held on an island like this one? "Yep," Shogo nodded. "Hyogo Prefecture also shares the Sito Inland Sea. It seems like programs held in prefectures along the Sito Inland Sea coast are always held on islands. I mean, there are at least 1,000 islands in this small sea." Shogo then told him to wait and descended the slope toward the clinic with his shotgun cocked. He crouched down and first examined the minivan. Then he snuck up to the building and circled it. When he returned, he examined the sliding door entrance. It seemed to be locked, so Shogo flipped his shotgun and shattered the frosted glass window with the sawed-off gun stock. Then he stuck his hand into the V-shaped opening, unlocked the door, and entered the building. After watching him do this, Shuya tilted his head back to Noriko, whose head was resting against his back.
"Noriko, we're here," Shuya said, but Noriko could only moan.
"Huh?" Her breathing was still heavy. After 5 full minutes, Shogo poked his head out of the entrance and signaled Shuya to join him. Shuya cautiously descended the 2-meter drop so he wouldn't lose his balance and approached the clinic. A thick, grimy wooden sign with the traces of weather-worn letters that read Okushima Island Medical Clinic hung right beside the entrance. Shuya slipped by Shogo, who kept watch, holding his shotgun. He entered, followed by Shogo, who shut the door tightly. Right near the entrance, there was a small waiting room. On the left, there was a long green couch with a white cover on the worn, cream-colored carpet. The wall clock made a ticking sound as it approached 3 o'clock. The right side appeared to be the examination room. Shogo jammed the door shut with a broom and then signaled Shuya, "Over here." Although they were supposed to take their shoes off, Shuya stepped up with his sneakers on and entered the room on the right. There was a wooden desk in front of the window and what appeared to be a doctor's black leather chair. A green vinyl stool squatted in front of it. Even though the clinic was small, it was still infused with the sterile odor of disinfectant. Beyond a thin green curtain hanging from metal pipes were 2 beds. Shuya carried Noriko to the bed in front and gently put her down. He thought of having her take off his school coat, but then decided against it. After Shogo quickly pulled the curtain shut, he said, "Blankets," and gave Shuya 2 thin brown blankets that had been folded into small squares. Shuya took them, and after some thought, spread one of them on the other bed. Then he moved Noriko there and spread the other blanket over her. He made sure the blanket went up to her shoulders. Shogo was rummaging through a gray office cabinet that was probably the medicine cabinet. Shuya crouched down by Noriko's head and combed the sweaty hair against her cheeks back to her ears. She seemed dazed. Her eyes were closed and she continued to breathe heavily. "Damn it," Shuya muttered. "Noriko, are you all right?" Noriko squinted at him as she said, "Uh-huh." She might be faint from the high fever, but her mind was clear enough to respond. "How about some water?" Noriko barely nodded. Shuya took out a new bottle of water from the day pack Shogo had tossed onto the floor and tore off the seal. He held her up and helped her drink it. Shuya wiped off the water spilling from the side of her mouth with the back of his hand. "Is that enough?" Shuya asked, and Noriko nodded. Then he lay her down and waved to Shogo. "Any medicine?"
Hold on, Shogo replied. He rummaged through another lower cabinet and pulled out a cardboard box. He opened it and read the directions. It seemed to be what he was after. He extracted what looked like a small bottle and an ampoule. The bottle was filled with white powder. Do you swallow that? Shuya asked. Shogo answered, No, it's for injections. Shuya was a little shocked. You know how to use that? Shogo turned on the faucet in the back of the room. No water came out, as expected, and Shogo clicked his tongue. He pulled out his water bottle from his day pack and washed his hands. Then he set a needle on a syringe and extracted the contents of the ampoule. Don't worry, I've done this before. Really? Shuya felt like he was constantly repeating this phrase to Shogo. Shogo broke the seal of the small bottle and injected the contents of the syringe into it, filling it up with the liquid from the ampoule. After removing the syringe, he held the bottle and shook it vigorously. Then he inserted the needle again to extract the liquid mixture. After preparing another syringe like this, he finally approached them. Is she going to be all right? Shuya asked again. What about side effects or shock? That's what I'm going to check for now. Just do as I say. Pull out Noriko's arm. Unsure of the situation, Shuya lifted the side of the blanket and rolled up both the sleeves of his school coat and her sailor suit. Her arm was very thin, and her healthy-looking dark skin had now become excruciatingly white. Noriko, Shogo asked her, have you ever had any allergic reactions to any medicine? Noriko opened her eyes again in a daze. Shogo repeated, Are you allergic to any medicine? Noriko shook her head slightly. Good. I'm going to test you first, though. Shogo held her arm out with her palm up, then took a cotton swab soaked with disinfectant and wiped the area between her wrist and elbow. He slowly inserted the needle, injecting only a small amount of the liquid. A slight bump formed on this area of her skin. Shogo took out another syringe and performed another injection. What are you doing? Shuya asked. One of them is real medicine. If she's in the same condition 15 minutes later, we won't have to worry about side effects. It means we can probably use the medicine. But, Shogo quickly took out another larger bottle from the cardboard box. He placed it on the small desk nearby, prepared another syringe, and looked over at Shuya. It's not easy to diagnose septicemia. To be honest, I can't tell whether this is from septicemia or just a cold. Antibiotics are pretty potent, and that's why we're testing this on her. But the fact is, my experience and knowledge are pretty limited, so injecting her with this syringe could be pretty dicey. On the other hand, holding Noriko's hand, Shuya waited for him to continue. Shogo took a breath. If she is suffering from septicemia, then we have to treat her as soon as possible. Otherwise, it'll be too late. 15 minutes passed by quickly. In the meantime, Shogo checked her pulse again and took her temperature. The thermometer read 39 degrees Celsius. No wonder she could barely stand. Shuya couldn't tell the difference between the two adjacent marks from the syringes. Shogo also appeared to reach the same conclusion and took the larger syringe. Crouching down slightly, Shogo asked, Noriko, are you awake? Noriko answered with her eyes shut. Uh-huh. I'll be honest. I don't know if you're suffering from septicemia or not. I think you probably are. Noriko nodded slightly. She must have been able to follow Shuya and Shogo's conversation moments ago. It's all right. Go ahead. Shogo nodded and inserted the syringe, this time deeply. He injected the liquid and removed the needle. Then he wiped her arm with the cotton and told Shuya, Hold this. Shogo took the empty syringe and walked over to the sink to toss it away. Then he came back. Now she's got to sleep. You look after her for a while. If she looks thirsty, you can use the whole bottle. Shuya said, But that's... Shuya shook his head. Don't worry. I found a well behind the building. As long as we boil the water, we can drink it. Shogo left the room. Shuya turned toward the bed. With his right hand pressing the cotton swab and his left hand gently holding Noriko's hand, He watched over her. 22 students remaining. Chapter 42. Noriko fell asleep almost immediately. Shuya checked to make sure she wasn't bleeding from the shot. Then he tossed the cotton swab, tucked her arm under the blanket, and left the room. The doctor's living quarters were beyond the waiting room next door. There was a kitchen at the end of the hall on the right. Shogo was in there. The gas stove next to the sink wasn't operating, but on it was a large pot filled with water, and under it a pile of charcoal was glowing red. Shogo was standing on a table, looking through a built-in ceiling cabinet across from the sink. Shuya noticed for the first time that Shogo was wearing New Balance sneakers. He had assumed they were some domestic brand like Mizuno or Kagaboshi. New Balance. He'd never seen them before. Whatever. What are you doing? He asked. Looking for food. I found some rice and miso, but nothing else. The vegetables in the fridge are rotten. Shuya shook his head. You're stealing. Of course I am, Shogo said dryly, and then added while he continued rummaging, Forget about it. Just be ready. Anyone can show up at any moment. If the kid with the machine gun shows up, we'll be dead. So be ready. Shuya replied, Yeah, all right. Shogo jumped off the table. The New Balance shoes squeaked against the floor. Is she asleep? He asked. Shuya nodded. Shogo pulled out another pot from under the sink, walked up to the plastic rice container in the corner, and poured rice into the pot. So you're boiling rice?
Yep.
Noriko won't recover eating that terrible bread. Shogo scooped up a bowl of water from the bucket on the floor and poured it into the pot. He combed through the rice and only changed the water once. Next to the boiling water, he placed several pieces of charcoal from his day pack onto the other burner, then took out a pack of cigarettes and emptied them into his pocket. Then he crumbled the pack, lit it with his lighter, and stuck it into the charcoal. Once the charcoal was lit, he put the lidded pot of rice on the burner. It was an impressive sight. Damn, Shuya said. Shogo took a break as he lit up a cigarette and looked at Shuya. You're so good at everything.
Yeah, Shogo answered lightly.
But something else flashed through Shuya's mind. The moment Kaori Minami was murdered. You know what's going to happen, but there's nothing you can do to stop it. Slow motion. Kaori spins around and the left side of her head's blown off. It was blown away. Did you see that? If it had been Shogo instead of Shuya, the outcome wouldn't have been so horrible.
Are you still bummed about Kaori? Shogo said.
Once again, Shogo's psychic powers were on. The sunlight didn't reach this far inside, but that didn't seem to affect him. Shogo shook his head. Don't let it get to you. It was a bad situation. You did your best. Shogo's voice was kind, but Shuya looked down. The corpse of Kaori Minami collapsed on her side inside a grimy farm equipment shack, the pool of blood gradually spreading, oozing outward. By now, beginning to congeal. But the body would just stay there, with no ceremony, just left there like a disposed mannequin sprawled across the floor of the shack. Of course, in that sense, she was no exception to Tatsumishi Oki, Kyoichi Motobuchi, Yukiko Katano, and Yumiko Kusaka. Everyone else was in the same boat. He felt like puking. They were all lying there on the ground, already close to 20 of them. Shogo. The words spilled out. In response, Shogo tilted his head and slightly moved his hand that was holding the cigarette. What happens to the dead?
Their bodies, Shuya asked. Are they left there until this stupid game is over? So they just start rotting while the game is going on?
Shogo answered as if it were an official matter. That's right. Once it's over, the following day, a cleanup crew is hired to take care of them.
Cleanup crew? Shuya bared his teeth.
Yep, I heard about it from someone who works for the subcontractor, so I'm sure it's true. Self-defense forces soldiers are too proud to perform such menial tasks. Of course, government officials accompany the crew to collect the collars and examine the bodies. You know,
so the news media can report the number of deaths by strangulation, all that stuff.
Shuya was pissed. He recalled that final part of the news report, the meaningless causes of death and itemization of each student's fate. But he also realized something and knit his brows.
Shogo saw this and asked, "What's up?"
"Well, that doesn't make sense. I mean, these..."
Shuya raised his hand up to his neck. His fingers touched the collar's cold surface, the sensation no longer so strange.
"I thought these were a secret. Shouldn't they collect them before the hired hands come in?"
Shogo shrugged. "The cleaning crew have no idea what they're for. They probably just assume they're used as markers. The guy I talked to didn't even remember them until I asked him about them. So there's no rush. They can deal with the callers after the cleanup crews collected the bodies, right?"
It was true. But even so, something else bugged him.
"Hold on. What if one of these is defective? Let's say it breaks down and someone who's alive is assumed to be dead. Couldn't that student escape? Shouldn't they confirm all the dead right after the game?"
Shogo raised his brows.
"You talk like you work for the government."
"No," he stammered. "It's just that..."
"I doubt they could ever be defective. Think about it. If they actually could break down, this game couldn't proceed smoothly. Besides, if a student equipped with weapons turned out to be alive, they couldn't even afford to check the bodies. It turned into another battle."
Shogo took a drag as he considered it more thoroughly.
"This is just my guess, but I think each collar is loaded with multiple systems so that if one breaks down, another gets switched on. Even if one system became defective, the chances of that being at least less than 1 in 100, if the systems were combined, the probability would practically be reduced to 0. In other words," he said, looking at Shuya, "it would be impossible for us to escape that way."
Shuya understood. He saw no reason to object. Once again, he couldn't help but be impressed by Shogo's intelligence. But then, the question he promised not to ask crossed his mind, which was, how did Shogo plan to beat a perfect, escape-proof system?
Before he could consider it, Shogo said, "Anyway, look, I have to apologize."
"About what?"
"About Noriko. I was wrong. We should have treated her sooner."
"No." Shuya shook his head. "It's okay. Thanks. I would have been useless on my own."
Shogo exhaled and fixed his gaze on a part of the wall.
"We'll just have to wait and see. If it's just a cold, then her fever will go down as soon as she gets some rest. And if it turns out it's from septicemia, then the medicine should kick in."
Shuya nodded. He was grateful they had Shogo. Without Shogo, he would have been helpless, doomed to watch Noriko deteriorate. He was also sorry for saying to Shogo, "You can forget about our deal," and heading off here. It was immature. Shogo must have made his decision after carefully weighing the risk of moving during the day against Noriko's condition.
Shuya decided he should apologize.
"Hey, I'm sorry, saying you were on your own and all. I just got so anxious."
Still looking away from Shuya, Shogo shook his head and smiled.
"No, you made the right decision. End of conversation."
Shuya took a breath and decided to let it go. Then he asked, "Is your father still a practicing doctor?"
Shogo shook his head as he took a drag.
"No."
"What's he doing? Is he still in Kobe?"
"No, he died."
Shogo said it casually.
Shuya's eyes opened wide.
"When?"
"Last year, while I was playing this game. By the time I got back, he was dead. He probably got in a scuffle with the government."
Shuya's face stiffened. He was beginning to understand the glimmer in Shogo's eyes when he'd said, "I'm going to tear up this fucked up country." The moment Shogo ended up in the program, Shogo's father must have tried some kind of protest, which must have been met with a bullet. It occurred to Shuya that the parents of some of his classmates might have ended up the same way.
"I'm sorry. I didn't mean to pry."
"Don't worry about it."
Shuya paused and then asked another question.
"Then you moved to Kagawa Prefecture with your mother?"
Shogo shook his head and again replied,
"No, my mom died when I was a kid. I was 7. She died from illness. My dad used to cry over the fact that even he couldn't save her. But my dad specialized in surgery, like abortions. Nervous disorders were out of his field. Shuya apologized again. I'm sorry. Shogo chuckled. Hey, it's all right. We're both orphans, right? And it's true about getting a lifetime pension. I've got enough to live on. Although they don't give you as much as they say they do. Bubbles began to form at the bottom of the first large pot. The charcoal under the rice pot was still mostly black, but the charcoal under the large pot was flaming red. The heat reached the table where Shuya and Shogo were standing next to each other. Shuya sat up on the table, which was covered with the flower-pattern vinyl tablecloth. Without warning, Shogo suddenly said, "You are good friends with Yoshitoki Kuninobu." Shuya looked over at Shogo and scrutinized his profile. Then he looked ahead. It felt like a while since he'd last thought of Yoshitoki. He felt a little guilty about it. "Yeah," he answered. "We've known each other forever." After hesitating a little, Shuya continued. "Yoshitoki had a crush on Noriko." Shogo continued smoking, listening. Shuya wondered whether he should continue with what he was about to say. It had nothing to do with Shogo, but he decided to tell him anyway. Shogo was a friend now. It was all right for him to know, and besides, they had time to kill right now. "Yoshitoki and I were at this orphanage called the Charity House." "I know." Shuya nodded. "There's all kinds of kids there. I ended up there when I was 5. My parents were killed in a car accident. But that's unusual. Most of them..." Shogo understood. "End up there because of domestic problems. They're illegitimate children." Shuya nodded. "So you know." "A little." He took a deep breath. "Well, Yoshitoki was illegitimate. Of course, no one at the orphanage told him, but there are ways to find out. He was conceived from an illicit affair, and both sides refused to take him in, so..." The water made a gurgling sound. "I remember something Yoshitoki once said to me. It was a long time ago, probably when we were still in elementary school." Shuya recalled that moment. They were in the corner of the school playground, rocking back and forth on a big swing made of a wooden log and wire rope. "Hey, Shuya, I was thinking."
"What?"
Shuya responded in his usual casual voice, kicking at the ground to rock the log. Yoshitoki didn't put much effort into it, letting his legs dangle from both sides of the log.
"Well, what is it? Spit it out."
"Well, do you have a crush on anyone?"
"Oh, please."
Shuya grinned. He knew it was something about girls.
"So that's it? What's the matter? You have a crush on someone, huh?"
"Well..." Yoshitoki evaded the question and once again asked, "Well, do you?"
Shuya thought about it. By then he was Wild 7, so he'd gotten several love letters, but at the time, he never fell head over heels for anyone in particular. As it turned out, he wouldn't until he met Kazumi Shintani. He answered, "Well, I think there's some cool girls." Yoshitoki didn't say anything back, so Shuya assumed he wanted to hear more. He continued speaking in a light tone. "Kumoto's not bad. She actually wrote me a love letter. I haven't, responded, though. Then there's Utsumi, who's on the volleyball team. She's pretty cool. That's my type, you know, real outgoing." Yoshitoki looked pensive. "What is it? I told you, now you tell me. Who is it?" But Yoshitoki only said, "No, that's not it." Shuya knit his brows. "What is it then?" Yoshitoki seemed quite hesitant, but then he said, "You see, I never really understood."
"Huh?"
"I mean..." His legs dangled listlessly. "I think if you really loved someone, you'd marry her, right?"
Yeah, Shuya replied with an idiotic look on his face.
"Yeah, if I loved someone, I'd want to marry her. I mean, I don't feel that way about anyone."
"Right?" Yoshitoki said, as if it were only natural. Then he asked, "So let's say you just can't get married for some reason. If you ended up having a kid with her, wouldn't you still want to raise the kid?" Shuya felt a little uncomfortable. He'd just begun to get the idea of how babies were made.
Having a kid? Hey, you're still a kid. That's dirty stuff.
You know, I heard that That was when Shuya finally remembered Yoshitoki was born as a result of an illicit affair and that neither of his parents wanted him. Startled, he held back what he was about to say. Yoshitoki was staring at the log between his thighs. Then he mumbled, "My parents weren't like that." Shuya suddenly felt really bad for him.
"Hey, Yoshi."
Yoshitoki looked up at Shuya and said somewhat forcefully, "So I just don't know. Loving someone? I don't feel like I can trust that sort of thing." Shuya continued pushing with his legs, but he had no choice but to stare back at Yoshitoki. He felt as if he were being addressed in a language from another planet. At the same time, it sounded like a dreadful prophecy. "I think." His hands by his waist, Shuya gripped the corners of the table covered with the vinyl tablecloth. Shogo continued smoking, squinting his eyes. "I think Yoshitoki was a lot more mature at that point already. I was just a silly kid. And ever since then, Yoshitoki never brought it up. Even after we entered junior high and I fell for someone." This was Kazumi Shintani. "That kind of worried me." Another gurgling sound. "But then one day he told me he liked Noriko. I acted like it wasn't a big deal, but I was so happy for him. And that was... Shuya looked away from Shogo. He knew he was about to cry. Once he managed to hold back his tears, he continued, without looking at Shogo. "That was only 2 months ago." Shogo remained silent. Shuya looked at Shogo again. "So you see, I have to protect Noriko to the very end." After staring back at Shuya for a while, Shogo only said, "I see," and rubbed out his cigarette against the tablecloth. "Don't tell Noriko. I'll tell her about Yoshitoki once we've gotten out of this game." Shogo nodded and replied, "All right." 22 students remaining. Chapter 43. 5 hours had passed since the Macintosh PowerBook 150's connection to the internet had been cut off with a warning beep. Shinji Mamura scrolled through a document in one of the windows on the display monitor of the 150, which was now reduced to a word processor. He'd worked on the phone, checked the connections, and rebooted over and over, but the gray monitor responded with the same message. Finally, after disconnecting all the modem and phone cords, he came to the conclusion his cell phone had completely broken down. Without a phone line, he couldn't even access his home computer. And of course, calling all the girls he'd ever gone out with and sobbing over how he was, about to die, but I loved you the most, was out of the question. He still believed he could get to the bottom of this and considered taking apart his cell phone, but then stopped. A chill ran down his spine. It was obvious now why he wasn't able to dial in anymore. The government had managed to locate the line test number used by the DTT technician, the number used for the special phone with the counterfeit second ROM he'd painstakingly built. They'd cut off all connections, including this one. The question was, how had they managed to do this? His hacking had been flawless. He knew that much. The only way he could imagine the government discovering his hacking was through some method outside their computer's internal security system, their warning system, and other manual monitoring systems. And now that they knew, the moment Shinji realized what it was, his hand went for the collar around his neck. Now that the government knew, it wouldn't be all that surprising if the bomb went off, would it? They probably wouldn't spare Yutaka either. Thanks to this realization, the government supplied water and bread they had for lunch tasted even worse. After Yutaka saw Shinji turn off the laptop, he asked for an explanation. Shinji only replied, "It's no good. I don't know why, but it's not working. Maybe the phone's broken." Ever since then, Yutaka's mood became gloomy, and he slouched back to the way he'd been earlier that morning. Other than the occasional gunshots and brief exchanges, it remained silent. Shinji's great escape plan that had mesmerized Yutaka had completely fallen apart. But I'll still make them regret they didn't kill me right away, no matter what. He thought a little, then dug into his pants pocket and pulled out an old pocket knife he'd carried around with him ever since he was a kid. There was a small tube tied to the key ring on the knife. Shinji examined the scratched-up tube. His uncle had given him the knife a long time ago, and the tube was, like the earring in his left ear, another memento from his uncle. Like Shinji, his uncle had kept it chained to a small knife and always carried it around. The thumb-sized tube, with its rubber ring under the cap, was a waterproof case used by soldiers. It was normally used to hold a document with name, blood type, and history of illness in case of injury. Others used it as a matchbox. Until his death, Shinji assumed his uncle kept that sort of thing in it too. But after he died, when he opened the tube, Shinji found something completely different inside. In fact, the tube's casing itself was carved out of a special alloy and contained two smaller cylinders inside. Shinji took out the two cylinders. He had no idea what they were. The only thing he could tell was that their contents were supposed to be mixed. The thread of the screw from one of the cylinders fit perfectly into the other one. The reason why they were kept apart was that it was risky to connect them. And once he found out what they were for, after some research, no wonder they were separate, otherwise you couldn't carry those cases around. He still had no idea why his uncle carried it wherever he went. It served no particular purpose, or maybe like the earring Shinji wore, his uncle had merely held on to it to remind himself of someone. Anyway, it was another piece of evidence from his uncle's past for Shinji to contemplate. Shinji turned the squeaky cap and opened it. He hadn't opened it since his uncle died. He dropped the two cylinders into the palm of his hand. Then he opened the seal of the smaller cylinder. It had been stuffed with cotton to make it shockproof. There was the dull yellow of brass underneath the cotton. After examining it, he returned both cylinders to the larger container and screwed the cap back on. He thought that if he ever had to use this, it would be after they escaped the island, or after messing up the school computer. It might have been handy after they equipped themselves and attacked Sakamochi and the others, but now this was all they had. He flipped out the blade from his pocket knife. The sun had moved west, and the bushes reflecting against the silver steel were dark yellow. Then he pulled out a pencil from his school coat pocket. It was the pencil they all used to write the phrase, "We will kill each other," before the game began. Because he'd used it to mark the forbidden zones and check off the names of dead classmates, its point was now blunt. Shinji sharpened the pencil with his knife. Then he pulled out his map from another pocket and turned it over. It was blank. Yutaka. Yutaka had been hugging his knees and gazing at the ground. He looked up. His eyes were shining. "Did you come up with something?" he asked. Shinji wasn't exactly sure why Yutaka's response ticked him off. It might have been the tone of his voice, or maybe the words. Shinji felt like saying, "What the hell? Here I am banging my head against the wall trying to come up with an escape plan, and all you've been doing is sitting on your ass. You swore you were going to get back at them for Izumi Kanai, but you haven't done squat. You think this is a fast food restaurant where I'm working the register? You want some fries with that?" But Shinji restrained himself. Yutaka's round cheeks were sunken, and his cheekbones stuck out. It was only natural. He must have been worn out by the pressure of this game that could end at any moment for them. Ever since he was a kid, Shinji had always been the best athlete in the class. This changed in his second year of junior high when he was joined by Shuya Nanahara and Kazuo Kirayama. He could beat them in basketball, but he wasn't sure about the other sports. His uncle had taken him mountain climbing ever since he was a kid, and he was confident in any competition that required stamina. But not everyone was built like the third man. Yutaka was a poor athlete, and when the cold season came, he was often absent. Fatigue must have been overwhelming him, and it might be numbing his thinking, too. That was when Shinji realized something important. Wasn't the fact that he was even a little upset at Yutaka an indication of his own fatigue? Of course. Given how their chances of survival were close to nil, it would have been much stranger not to be worn out. No. I have to be careful. If this were a basketball game, you just feel bad about losing. But in this game, you end up dead.
Shinji shook his head.
What's wrong? Yutaka asked. Shinji looked up at him, forcing a smile.
Nothing. Hey, I just want to take a look at the map, okay?
Yutaka came over to Shinji.
Hey, Shinji raised his voice. There's a bug on your neck.
Yutaka touched his neck.
I'll get it.
Shinji stopped him and approached Yutaka. He fixed his eyes on the nape of Yutaka's neck, but he was searching for something else.
Oh, it's moved, he said, and got behind him. Shinji examined his neck again.
Did you get it?
As he listened to Yutaka's shrill voice, Shinji took a closer look. Then he lightly brushed the nape of Yutaka's neck. He crushed the imaginary bug with the sole of his sneakers and, pretending, he picked it up and, pretending once again, tossed it out.
I got it, he said.
He was now facing Yutaka and added, looked like a little centipede.
Oh, man.
Yutaka rubbed the nape of his neck and looked over where Shinji had, apparently, tossed it, grimacing. Shinji broke into a slight grin and said, Come on, let's look at the map.
Yutaka looked over, then knit his brows when he saw that it was turned over.
Shinji waved his index finger to get his attention and scribbled on the back of the map. His writing wasn't very neat. Several scrawled letters appeared at the edge of the paper.
They can hear us.
Yutaka's face twitched and asked, Really? How can you tell? Shinji quickly put his hand over Yutaka's mouth.
Yutaka understood and nodded.
Shinji released his hand and said, I just know. I know a lot about insects. That one wasn't poisonous.
Then just to be sure, he scribbled again. Pretend to check map. Don't say anything to make them suspicious.
Well, now that the computer's failed, there's nothing we can do, Shinji said, providing some fake commentary. Then he wrote, They heard my explanation and cut the MAC connection. I screwed up. They know some of us are going to resist, so they're monitoring our conversations. Should have known.
Yutaka took out his pencil from his pocket and wrote under Shinji's scrawled letters. His writing was much neater than Shinji's.
How can they use a monitoring device on such a big island?
He had copied Shinji's spelling for monitoring, but device was spelled incorrectly.
Whatever. This wasn't composition class.
I think we should look for others. We can't do much on our own, so...
Shinji said as he lightly tapped on his collar with his finger. Yutaka's eyes widened as he nodded.
Shinji then scribbled again. I checked your collar. It doesn't seem to have a camera, only listening device. I don't think there are any cameras in the area. Maybe satellites, but the woods are covering us. They can't see what we're doing now.
Spelling wasn't Shinji's strongest suit either.
Yutaka's eyes widened again, and he glanced upward. The branches were swaying, cutting them off completely from the blue sky.
Yutaka's face then stiffened suddenly as if he'd realized something. He gripped his pencil and wrote on the back of the map.
Mac stopped working because you told me about it. If not for me, you would have succeeded.
Shinji poked Yutaka's shoulder with the index finger of his left hand and smiled at him. Then he scribbled, Don't sweat it. Should have been more careful. Collars could have gone off the moment they heard, but they're mercifully letting us live.
Yutaka touched the nape of his neck, eyes wide.
He stared at Shinji and then tightened his lips and nodded. Shinji nodded back at him.
I wonder where they're hiding out.
I'm writing my plan here. Fake our conversation. Just go with the flow.
Yutaka nodded and then quickly responded.
But I'm not sure we can trust anyone.
Good going.
Shinji grinned. Yutaka grinned back.
That's true. I think we can trust Shuya.
I want to hook up with Shuya.
If comp worked, we could have saved others, but now we can only worry about saving ourselves.
All right with that?
Yutaka considered it and then wrote,
Not looking for Shuya?
Right. Can't afford to worry about others anymore.
Yutaka bit his lip, but finally nodded. Shinji nodded back. If this works out, game will get held up, might give others chance to escape. Yutaka gave two small nods. You think everyone's hiding on the mountain like us? Maybe some of them are hiding in houses. Maybe. Shinji was deliberating over what to write next when Yutaka wrote, "What's the plan?" Shinji nodded and gripped his pencil. "I've been waiting for something to happen since morning." Yutaka tilted his head, his pencil down. "Announcement that game has been canceled. I'm still waiting." Yutaka looked surprised and tilted his head in bewilderment. Shinji grinned at him. "When I got access to school comp, I found all backup files and file search apps. Then before I downloaded, I infected them all with virus." Yutaka silently formed the word virus with his mouth. "Hey Yutaka, how about writing it out?" Shinji wrote, "Virus would enter school comp system if they search files or backups. Would wreak havoc on the system and freeze game." Impressed, Yutaka gave several brief nods. Shinji knew it was a waste of time, but wrote it out anyway. "I designed virus. It's cool. It's like getting athlete's foot, but 100 times worse." Yutaka held back the urge to laugh, but gave a broad grin. "It'll destroy all data and play the Star Spangled Banner on repeat. It'll drive 'em crazy." Yutaka held his stomach, doing his best not to laugh, and pressed his hand against his mouth. Shinji also did his best not to burst out laughing. "Now they've discovered me. Maybe they won't get those files, then game will have to stop. But it hasn't. So they've only done routine checks. I didn't go through any main files."
"Why don't we go find them then? Isn't that dangerous?"
"Yeah, but we have a gun."
"My plan, make them get files. We'll activate virus."
Shinji pulled his laptop over and showed Yutaka the document he'd been looking over. It was a 42-line text file. The data download had been interrupted, but of all the copied files, this was the most important one. The horizontal text. Each row began with a listing on the left, from M01 to M21, followed by F01 to F21, in succession. Each listing was accompanied by a 10-digit number resembling a phone number, all in succession as well. Finally, there were what appeared to be random 16-digit numbers. A small comma was inserted between these three listings. The file name at the heading was cryptic. Guadalcanal, Shiroiwa 3B. "What's this?" Yutaka wrote. Shinji nodded. "These are the numbers assigned to our callers." Yutaka gave a nod as if to say, "Oh." So M01 was male student number 1, Yoshio Akamatsu, and F01 was female student number 1, Mizuo Inada, that weird girl. "Callers are like cell phones. Each band has a number and password. Use numbers to set them off. So..." Shinji stopped and looked at Yutaka. "If data's infected with virus, we won't have to worry about callers blowing us up. Virus will keep spreading. If they have backup files, they can't stop it. If they reprogram to stop virus, we'll be in trouble. But it will still buy us time. How about tossing pebbles at certain places to see if someone comes running out? Wait, what if it's a girl? She might scream. That could be dangerous, not just for us, but the girl. I mean, assuming she's not bad. Huh? How will you make them do it? Outside school building, did you see room for SDF?
Yutaka nodded.
Computers in there, remember?
Yutaka's eyes opened wide again as he shook his head. I couldn't afford to.
Shinji chuckled a little. I got a good look. They have a row of desktop computers and large server. Someone stuck out, though. It wasn't Ensign, or was it Ensign? Forget it. He had a pin on his uniform. He was the tech. A computer runs this whole game. All we have to do is attack the school so they think we might, another word I can't spell, annihilate their data. If we can get all the materials we need, we
actually blow up the entire computer. Shinji stopped writing. He spread his hands with the exaggerated motion of a magician. Then he wrote on the map, "Bomb the school. Escape by sea." Yutaka's eyes were now bulging. He mouthed the word, "Bomb?" Shinji grinned. "Maybe we should look for some weapons, though. That fork is pretty useless." "Uh-huh. Yeah. We need gasoline. There's a gas station at the harbor, but we can't get there. There are several cars here, though. Maybe have fuel. Worst case, use oil. We also need fertilizer." Yutaka knit his brows, puzzled. "Fertilizer?" Shinji nodded and tried to write out the name of the fertilizer compound, but he didn't know how to spell it. He was a casualty of spell check. Anyway, what mattered was the molecular formula. "Ammonium nitrate. If we can find it, we can make bomb with gasoline." Shinji pulled out his knife and the tube tied to it. He showed it to Yutaka. "This is a detonator. Too complicated to explain why I have one. I just do." Yutaka looked thoughtful. Then he wrote, "That, uncle?" Shinji grinned and nodded. Yutaka knew because Shinji was always going on and on about his uncle. Yutaka wrote, "How are we going to bomb the school? We can't get near it. Make a giant sling with trees? Aha." Shinji smiled. "No, not precise enough. Too bad we don't have a bunch of bombs. But we have only one detonator, so we have only one chance. Rope and pulley." Yutaka opened his mouth as if to say, "Oh." "Can't get near school, but can go to mountain area and area on other side of school." Shinji flipped over the map and indicated the areas to Yutaka. Then he flipped it back over. "From mountain to flat." "No, wrong. Tie rope from flats to mountain, about 300 meters. Stretch it tight so we can slide bomb down on pulley. Then cut rope when it's on top of school. My special slam dunk." Once again impressed, Yutaka nodded enthusiastically. "It might be best to find weapons during the day." "Yeah, I think so too. It'll be easier than finding someone." "Let's get to work. There's a pulley by a well I saw. Get gas from cars. Fertilizer and rope? I don't know. Can we find rope that long?" They fell silent, but then Yutaka quickly wrote, "Let's go for it." Shinji nodded. "We might kill Sakamochi and soldiers, but all we have to do is make them think data's damaged." Then he pointed at his neckband and wrote, "These can't kill us." "Then escape by sea?" Shinji nodded. "But I can't swim." He looked at Shinji warily. Shinji interrupted Yutaka's writing and wrote, "Full moon tonight. Use tide current. According to my calculations, tide will carry us at 6 to 7 kph. If we swim fast, it will take less than 20 minutes to reach next island." Yutaka's admiration burst beyond the expression in his eyes as he shook his head vigorously. "What about guardship?" Shinji nodded. "They might find us, but because games run by computers, my guess is they will be lax. One ship for each direction is kinda lame. Their weakness. Once computer's down, they won't know where we are. Guardship will only be able to chase us on their own. If they have satellites, cameras can't see at night. We don't have to worry about our heads blowing up. We have chance to escape." "It won't be easy. I have another idea." Shinji dug into the day pack and pulled out a small transceiver. This was another item he found in someone's house. "I can increase output by customizing. Not hard. At sea, I'll send out an SOS. We can say our boat overturned or something." Yutaka's face beamed. "Some ship will pick us up." Shinji shook his head. "No. Government will come at us so we give them false location. We escape in opposite direction." Yutaka shook his head. Then he wrote out, "Shinji, you're awesome." Shinji shook his head and smiled. "All right then." He looked at his watch. It's already 4 p.m. We'll take off in 5 minutes. Uh-huh. Shinji felt worn out from all the handwriting, which he didn't do very often. He dropped his pencil.